Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Everyone Has a Story. This is the podcast that complements our quarterly lifestyle magazines in Noosa Magazine, which has been going for about 7 or 8 years, and the newly launched Hello Sunshine Magazine. We connect community through storytelling, and this podcast is another extension of that. Now, if you'd like your business or brand to be part of these exciting publications, reach out to our client service managers. You can catch us on Facebook or track us down on Instagram. My guest on today's episode of Everyone Has a Story is a guy whose parents were both Maltese. Now, he lost his mum when he was only 8 years of age, and his passion for the 1960s and the 1970s, his collectibles, his music, the films he's collected, and his cars, they all remind him of his late mum. He's got all of this incredible memorabilia together in what most blokes would describe as the ultimate man cave, and it's all on a property that he and his wife, Lisa Curry, are preparing as the Sunshine Coast hinterland retreat called Marley Retreat. He's an entertainer who brings the music of Elvis, Tom Jones, John Lennon, and many others to life up on stage. Everyone has a story, and today I'd like you to meet Mark Tabone.
I was born in Melbourne to both my parents were Maltese, and my dad was from Gozo, which is the smaller island of Malta, and so was my mum's mother, and they were related. They were actually, dad married his cousin's daughter, so
okay.
I'm kind of related to myself.
I can't quite work out the connection there, but I understand what's...
So, but my grandfather was from Malta, from the main island. This is on my mum's side, but both my grandparents on dad's side were from Gozo, the small island. They, I suppose after the war, you know, the generation of some people came out to Australia or the US or Canada, you know, but my family, I think dad followed his sisters, elder sisters, and came out to Melbourne. And that was in the late 50s. And I think around that time or a bit earlier, sort of mum was here as well, you know, so.
So they met here in Australia, or they came out as a couple?
They met here in Australia. So so dad was sort of visiting family, I suppose, and or extended family, and But and then they moved to the southeastern suburbs, got married, you know, moved out the southeastern suburbs of Melbourne. And that's when I was born in 66.
Very similar story. My mum was born here to Sicilian parents, but dad came out in 1952.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing from Sicily, you know, the same story after the war, there was lots of poverty and they all left looking for a better life, I suppose. And they ended up here in Australia. And, and lots of siblings, Mark, or just...
Yeah, I've got two brothers here and two sisters still over there because my mother passed away when I was 8 years old here in Australia. So we left because dad organized a holiday anyway that year, but he had to sort of postpone or cancel things because mum was sick in hospital. And then she died in September. And so for Christmas time, sort of dad took us over to his family in Malta to celebrate Christmas there.
Okay. I think with the intention of staying there or...?
I don't know. I think he was sussing it out because, you know, he needed his family at the time. So it was a bit very, you know, huge culture shock for us. And, and then when dad sort of spoke to us and said, oh, listen, we're just going back to Australia now to pack up and then we're coming back for good.
How did you feel about that?
I was 8 years old. I was open to anything at the time. I think my brother was... you know, very lost and didn't know what was going on. But I was very accepting of anything, you know, even the language. I was the first to pick it up and start, you know, really trying hard to speak Maltese. And so I think for me personally, it was good growing up there. It was a good foundation for who I am today.
So did you end up moving back to Malta and living there for a period of time?
Yeah, yeah. I was there for 9 years. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was, you know, I sort of left school and started working in hospitality, which is why a lot of people leave Malta to go to a better life overseas because of the work. You know, there's not as much employment as there is, you know, in countries like Australia. So I was working in hospitality and sort of worked my way up to, you know, restaurant manager and things like that. So I had a good job. But when my brother, he was 18, I was 17, he came up to me and said, "Oh, Mark, I've booked a ticket to go to Australia." I said, "What? What, are you leaving?" He said, "Yeah, I'm going for good." I said, "Oh, I'm coming with you." So I decided, you know, because I think at the time we were young and we felt that, oh, we're going to lose our Australian citizenship if we stay here.
Yeah.
And that's kind of was our mentality. So we, you know, we had family here. So we had all mum's side and some of dad's side as well. Yeah. So it wasn't like we were just going. But it was hard. It was hard leaving dad and, you know, the rest
he
of the
stayed.
Family.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, so dad stayed and because dad remarried.
Yeah.
And had another daughter. So, and so I've got two siblings, one half sibling that are still over there. And they sort of made a life of it over there.
You talked about getting a working start in hospitality, Mark. We're sitting here in probably what is one of the most amazing man caves ever. So it's filled with music and film and TV and vehicles that you're rebuilding. When you were a kid, what was your passion? Was your any one of these things that I've just mentioned? Cars,
well,
music, film?
It's funny you say that because I started collecting this memorabilia because it reminded me of the time when I was young in Australia.
Yeah.
So I'd see a telephone and I go, "Oh, we had one of those."
Yeah.
You know, and I'd buy it. Or a TV or, you know, it was that era. And I think because I lost my mum so young, I want to hold on to that era. That was a good time, you know, when she was around like that, you know. So not that I'm not happy now, you know what I mean? But I just love it. There's something about me personally and my inner self that connects with this stuff. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's hard to let go of it, you know, or Lisa, you know, she couldn't understand it at first, you know, she couldn't, she thought I was just some hoarder or crazy dude, you know, especially collecting women's clothing. But it was,
I didn't mention that because I didn't see any.
Well, I collect like
clothes from the 60s
from
the 60s, from
the
70s
it has a story. Everything has a story in here.
Yeah.
You know,
again, what you're talking about, and I understand the connection is you're talking about a nostalgic connection to a part of your life that has really fond memories for you.
Exactly.
And I understand what that I think you're only a year older than me. And I kind of pick up music, even though I'm a fan of a lot of 60s stuff. I pick up music in the 70s, though, for me, because I was born in 67. I think you were born in 66.
Yeah.
And so the 70s were really quite the music that was around. We'll get on to Elvis in a minute, because I actually became a big Elvis fan the year that he died.
Right.
And and that's happened quite often in my life. It's funny, you may not have a big interest in a particular artist, but when they pass away and their name is everywhere and it's in the papers and the obituaries, then you start investigating. I've done that a lot recently, people like George Jones and Tom Petty and Prince. But 77, I was 10 and Elvis passed away. And I'd like to get your, because you're an Elvis impersonator. So that night, you know, just after August 16, TVs around Australia, you know, they were showing the 68 special and then probably Aloha from Hawaii and things like that. Do you remember when you latched on to Elvis's music and that kind of era?
Yeah, clearly. My brother was the fan.
Yeah.
He was a year older. And Elvis had passed. And the first biopic came out. He said, "Do you want to come with me to see it?"
Is that the Kurt Russell one?
Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
That's the one. And there was something about that movie. I was 14-year-old looking for a hero. Yeah. Elvis was it. There was something about that movie. Then I had to research the real guy. I went to the record store the next day, bought like 3 albums, you know, started listening to
what did you buy?
Music. Oh, just...
Can you remember?
Well, random British, you know,
yeah,
compilations at the time because... And I've still got them.
Yeah.
But they were British, 80s or like 79, I think this came out. So it was 1980, somewhere around there. So, yeah, they were just British albums that came out.
Elvis compilations.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
They weren't like all the original stuff, you know, which they did a lot of reissues of those. Yeah. But it was, yeah, just the British compilations. But then it just started something within me. And Elvis is kind of magnetic to some people. So if you become a fan and you're magnetized to Elvis, that's it. You can't let it go for some reason. But so I was a fan for many years and, you know, went through a time where you want to be Elvis, you know. You know, I think a lot of teenagers or young people go through that.
Yeah.
But I grew out of that. But I just... Elvis introduced me to music. And
it was that, the gateway to,
it was,
to music.
It was, because... And acting as well. And I see myself more as... And rather than impersonator, I don't really like that word. But as an actor, as an Elvis actor, I do several characters... And not just Elvis, but I wanted to promote Elvis in a way where I could channel him and deliver a performance like you're seeing Elvis live. So I don't interpret it how some others do it and just do their own interpretation and do put themselves into it, you know, in the costume. I like to, you know, channel him and be him for that time that I'm on stage, you know.
What does the show involve? So I saw some posters around there where you're in all the leathers, like from the 68 special. And then there are the white jumpsuits from the 70s.
Yeah.
Do you go through all of those different...
I've done a lot of different shows and I've produced a few shows that we toured and things like that. Even shows where I've had Elvis's own entourage.
Well, you met Joe Esposito.
Joe Esposito.
I think at one stage, yeah.
That was I did a show for him as he was a guest and he was sitting back in a VIP section. So I did 3 eras, so I kind of grouped the songs with the costumes and things like that. So that's why it's important to group it and do the moves accurately. But Joe was sitting back and he thought, oh yeah, it's just another show. At the end of my show, he was up the front with his hands together like this. And I've got a photo.
Yeah.
And he's watching me like I've taken him
there,
you know. I've taken him there. It's like, and Linda Thompson, Elvis's longtime girlfriend, the first time she saw me, she goes, Mark, you just took me back there. You made me miss Elvis. And I thought I could just go backstage and see Elvis after the show.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I like doing. I like just becoming the character.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Do you have, for me, you know, I joke with Deb. Deb loves the films.
Yeah.
And I kind of dismiss the films a fair bit. And then I always say, you know, I always pick up Elvis from 68 onwards. And I think, you know, from that period, and then that album he released in 1969 from Elvis in Memphis, which was that the album he recorded at American Studios, was amazing.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, there were isn't it? Like one of the best studio albums from Elvis at the time. And just even the leftover tracks that became singles like Suspicious Minds. And then into the Vegas period and after that, that's when I love... He expanded the repertoire and started doing a lot of other people's songs. And what's your favorite kind of period?
It's
the way back to that rockabilly 50s or, you know.
It is interesting. My favorite period is the 69, early 70s. I think Elvis got control of himself again, you know. He did get lost in the movies, but he knew that and he was so bored and he just used to muck around during the shoots and things like that. But I think his acting ability was good. I think his motivation wasn't there for some of the movies. Because if you look at the first, you know, 4 movies that he did up until Jailhouse Rock when he went into the army, the formula was right. Like King Creole was written for James Dean, so it was a great script. Elvis took that, you know, and performed it with such passion and wanted to really do it justice. And I think, you know, he did well there. But, 69, 70, is kind of my favorite.
The peak period.
Yeah, and I think he, as I said before, he found himself again, and he had control, because Elvis was loyal to the Colonel, and I think he should have, you know.
Yeah, just watch that The Searcher on Netflix recently. I hadn't seen it. I know it's been out for a few years, but there was a lot of focus on the relationship between Colonel Tom Parker and Elvis in that doco.
Yeah.
When you're up on stage, Mark, and you do the Elvis shows, you sing. Mm. What, do you have a live band? What's the does the music come from?
So usually when COVID is not around, I was touring quite a bit with, say, a 8, 9, 10-piece band.
Yeah.
And
well, you needed an 8 or... Because the one thing I talked to Deb about this era too is it was the first time that in a live scenario, there wasn't just bass, drums and guitar, but there was an orchestra. And there were two backing, you know, the Jordanaires and then the Sweet Inspirations.
Two groups,
I think that was a big ensemble to have up on stage. How do you replicate that?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I am fortunate that this year in August 1 at Hamer Hall in Melbourne, I'm going to do like a record-breaking show, and it has 100 people on stage, musicians, singers. So it's going to be one of the biggest produced Elvis shows in the world. And it's kind of like watching a documentary live on stage, because there's going to be video footage, and then we, you know, go into the story, and I sing a group of songs and so on. So that's, you know, they chose me to do that role. So I'm very fortunate.
In August.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a one-off. It's so overproduced that they can't really tour it, you know.
Yeah, right. Right. That's incredible. Oh, we could talk about Elvis all day, but I want to talk about lots of other things.
Yeah.
First of all, the retreat that you and Lisa have. How did you meet Lisa? How did that happen?
Okay. So being an entertainer, I was entertaining on a charity walk. And it wasn't until like day 4 that I met up with the group. This was in Melbourne. So they were doing a walk from Melbourne to Portland, which is about 4.5-hour drive. And on the Thursday, on the Friday, I was doing a show. So I was going to go Thursday, catch up with them, do a little bit of walking for the charity on the Friday morning, and then do the show Friday night, Saturday night. So Lisa was the face of the walk. And we were both in our worlds at the time. So there wasn't any, you know, when I met Lisa, it was, you know, high hair going, things like that. And at the time, I wasn't, we were in our own worlds. Mm. But it was a friendship that developed 3 months later, 4 months later, that we sort of started chatting over combis.
Combis?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you what the connection was. Right. Maybe. Okay.
And then we found ourselves, I sort of, you know, during the walk, I was sort of at the end of my marriage anyway. And so I didn't expect to sort of jump straight into another relationship. I wasn't in the zone. So we started chatting over Messenger at first, and then I said, oh, can I have your phone number? You know, it's like I didn't even have a number. And then we started chatting and confiding in each other, because we were both single. And I think after about 6 weeks, Lisa said, oh, I think I want to come down to Melbourne to see you. And I said, oh, shit.
You know, why? Like,
I wasn't ready. You know, I wasn't in the zone, you know. And, you know, I said, I was straight up. I said, oh, listen, I don't want to hurt you. I don't know where this is going to go. And, you know.
Yeah.
But she said, I'm a big girl. I can take it. And and it was probably after our second date that I realized, hang on, something's hurting right around the chest area here, you know. So, and and it's funny because the first, you know, after one of the meetings that we had, at one of my shows up here that I invited them to come to, we had breakfast the next morning, and we were just sitting across the table having brekkie, and she was, you know, explaining her dream to have a property acreage and have retreats there and have people come to her rather than her going to people, you know, all the time. Mm. And, you know, having a barn and, you know, rustic vintage type feel. And I was sort of think, hey, that's my kind of feel, you know, that's what I want to do. And so we kind of, when we met up and, you know, started going out and she was looking around to buy a property, so I bought it with her. And then, yeah, we created the name. I think it was her late daughter's, Jamie's idea to call it Marley, which was a combination of Mark and Lisa. Mm-hmm. And we're really proud of what we've done here in the last 3 years, because it's such a beautiful space now. And, you know, we can't wait to, you know, have it up and running and have people come
over. It's an amazing space. And, you know, just the peacefulness, I suppose, of where you're located. There are other brands associated with you guys as well. Do you want to talk about those? Because didn't you guys go on the road with the Combi at some stage to promote?
Lisa's business is Happy Healthy You. You can probably talk to her about that. So happyhealthyyou.com.au. And that was, she years ago had sort of, you know, she felt like she was always in a bad mood and always stressed and things like that. So she was paddling, I think, with someone that introduced her to a naturopath, and they created a product called Happy Hormones. And it sort of done wonders, and they built up a group of women, because it's a private group through social media on Facebook. And they have, you know, a team of experts that answer questions, things like that. So it's a kind of a free community service. And through that, yeah, Lisa's just sort of expanded that and her brand. And yeah, she's very proud of that. So,
and was I right there that you guys took it on the road at some stage and then you were performing?
Or? We're starting to do that. So yeah. we haven't quite got there yet, but it is in the pipeworks, because she did a road trip years ago, and she did 100 towns all over Australia, and ended up in the heart of Australia in Uluru. That was her last one. So that was a great achievement for her. And I think, you know, when Lisa's ready to talk again and things like that, we're probably just going to hit the road probably a couple of weeks at a time. It won't be an ongoing tour. But yeah, we'll be combining her expertise with my entertainment.
We talked about when you guys met, and have I got this right as well? Once you got married in Australia?
Here.
But you took a global trip around the world with your wedding attire. Do you want to tell us what happened?
Yeah, so I left it up to Lisa to book the honeymoon, because she goes, oh, you know, let's just have a really great honeymoon. And I said, oh, you do it. Okay, no worries, you know. So she booked it all. She booked business class for us both, and she booked the hotels and things like that. We had transfers, and it was great, you know. But we took our outfits, our wedding outfits, and we dedicated one day of, we went to India, we went to Egypt, we went to Malta, and then we went to the desert in Abu Dhabi. So we dedicated one day to get dressed up and go and have photos with, you know,
in the wedding gear.
Yeah. So we've got some great shots.
Wow. And
they were all done on an iPhone 11. So, and I had a...
What year was this?
2018.
And going to Egypt, there was no problems?
No problems.
Wow.
We had to kind of camouflage to go into the pyramids. And then kind of just, we couldn't really make it look like we were doing a... But it wasn't really a wedding shoot. We just wanted a photo with the pyramids in the background. Yeah. So it's not... We didn't do a photo shoot as such. But yeah, so that was interesting. And it was great. We got some great shots, and you know, we researched the places to go in India, say, for instance.
Yeah.
Malta already knew the places, so that was all good. And being a hairdresser by trade myself.
You didn't even mention that at the top.
No.
You talked about hospitality.
Yeah, but I started hairdressing when I came back to Australia.
Right.
So when I was 18, yeah. I did an apprenticeship in hairdressing. So I was able to do Lisa's hair.
Yeah. You're a man of many talents, Mark. There's so much, you know, going on. Where do you find happiness? Can I ask, is it in here? We mentioned that we're sitting in your incredible man cave. I don't know do you call it a man? What do you call it?
Oh, yeah. I suppose you can call it a man cave. It's,
you know, there's an incredible Mini. There's a Cadillac. There's a Mustang. There's a moat that you're combi, you know, that you're restoring, and a combi. And
And the Beetle. Well, all my cars have a story too, because the Cadillac, you know, was Elvis's car. So I wanted a Cadillac to use for when I did Elvis for festivals, things like that. And there's something about, say, if you're headlining Parks Festival, which I did for 6 times, driving around in Cadillac, you know, people look at you, look at the image.
Stands out.
It just, you know, it goes with the act, you know, because I maintain that image. You know, not in character, but just maintain the image.
Well, it's great publicity, isn't it?
It is. But I've made so many people happy, just random people, because I've just been driving along the road. Two old ladies were just walking. I stopped and I said, "Do you want a lift?" And she just looked at me funny, like, "Is he for real?"
Yeah.
And like, because it's a bench front seat, I said, "Just hop in front seat." I opened the door for him, like a chauffeur.
It's a left-hand drive too, I noticed. Yeah.
And then this old lady, she's on the phone to her daughter. "You wouldn't believe it. I'm in a Cadillac with the Elvis. And like, she's just getting so excited. And it's just fun to, you know, just do those spontaneous things. And just driving around and just doing fun stuff like that. But, you know, Jim Morrison had a Mustang.
Okay. I was never a big Doors fan.
Weren't you?
No.
Yeah,
but tell me more.
Yeah. That's it. But he had a Mustang. So that was on my list of cars to get, you know. So, and I called that Mustang Mary because I inherited $20,000 from my grandmother when she died, because my mum had already passed. So I bought a car, didn't I? I thought, you know, but it's a great investment because I spent $26,000, now it's worth $100,000.
What year? What model
is it? It's a 66 Fastback.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the Mini, one of the characters I do is Austin Powers. Yeah. So I used that for festivals, you know, when I did Austin. John Lennon had a Beetle. That's another character I do.
You do Lennon?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, those of you in the cheaper seats, clap your hands.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Again, there's many different images of all these performances, well, the Lennon and the Elvis.
Yeah.
Did you have like a particular era
that I love doing?
Because, you know, the music changed so much and the image changed so much from 63 to 69, didn't it?
I think I'm a bit of a chameleon with my looks, and I can actually put on expression or, you know, a wig, and being a hairdresser, I can touch up the wig, of course.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But yeah, with Lennon, I go for the army jacket look, you know, that sort of, you know, the longer hair,
66. You know,
part in the middle. Right. It's probably a bit later.
Oh, yeah. I know.
Yeah. When he was solo, you know, when he was solo. And yeah, that sort of look.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I just love the whole thing about that era. Music, anything, furniture, cars, you know, you name it.
Yeah. And does Lisa, you mentioned the clothing before.
Yeah.
But does she share some of that passion and interest now in the memorabilia and you know, the Vespa that you've got in here? Just, it's amazing.
No. And she loves to collect vintage stuff, but she loves to use it.
Yeah.
So if I buy something, I go, no, you can't use those. You can't use those cups.
Yeah.
She doesn't understand the value of collecting, you know. She wants to buy something to use it.
To use it.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with all the stuff in here? I mean, obviously, it's on the retreat, and I don't know whether you're going to let... I wouldn't let people in, but, I mean, there is so much great memorabilia in here.
Yeah.
Would you ever consider putting
selling
it on...
It?
No. Yeah. Just putting it on display for people to look at.
Oh, yeah.
To come in and...
People do see this as a mini museum now. And I mean, it's not quite finished because I've been so busy on the property that I haven't finished cladding all the walls and, you know, just finish up the mezzanine and things like that. But yeah, I would like this in a way because everything's themed, if you notice in here. So the Cadillac corner is kind of...
Yeah, Elvis.
Elvis and the Cadillacs. So there's a mural there. I'm not sure whether you saw it in the corner with all the stars, Hollywood stars and legends. Uh-huh. With their Cadillacs.
Right, okay. No, yeah. I didn't see that.
And then this is kind of the UK. So that's not quite finished because I want that sort of, you know, Rolling Stones, Beatles, UK, Carnaby Street type feel. And then, just all movie posters around the movie screen and TVs.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then just the bar and, you know, collective, and that's just like the little kiddies area, all the kiddie toys and stuff.
But you've got an Andy Warhol style kind of with
that. That was a backdrop to one of my shows.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. So
do you do Tom as well?
I Tom do Jones? Tom Jones, yeah, right. In the 70s. So I kind of capture that look. So
and Buddy Holly, and who's in the top right?
That's Jerry Lewis. My son was involved in that show that night. That's a really young Jerry Lewis there. And, so I do Dean Martin as well, and I teamed up with my son. He does
Jerry. To do Jerry. Yeah, right.
So that was that show, and that was a backdrop for it. And then I said, oh, can I keep that, you know, or pay you something for it? She gave it to me. So the thing I do also is I've got a couple of really treasured pieces, not here, they're in safes, but I've got a pair of Elvis's pants.
Like real?
Real. Documented that they belong to Elvis.
And well, how'd you get your hands on those?
At an auction in New York. Yeah. And I've got...
Imagine they have massive flares.
Yeah, they... Well, not massive, but they are flared.
Yeah.
And there's a history... They've got a label that Elvis shopped at in the early 70s. So, it does make sense. There's a few photos of him wearing similar pants. They don't have belt loops. Because Elvis always wore the big belts over the top. And the pockets are actually sewn on so that he had no pockets.
Mm.
Because he never really carried money or MasterCards or anything like that.
Never did.
No, because he'd just say, Joe, can you pay for that?
Yeah. Did you see that movie when Elvis met Nixon?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I heard the story of that from Jerry Schilling himself.
Yeah, right.
I was so lucky with my career. And not many people, you know, have this opportunity. But for some reason, you know, I introduced a friend of mine that was the fan club president of Canada to Australia. I put her in touch with the right people to come to Winter Sun, which was a festival, and also Parks Elvis Festival. So we were friends, you know. I went to Canada a few times to their festival, performed there, and then I introduced her to Australia. In return, she said, Mark, thanks for getting me in touch with Winter Sun. I'm bringing Jerry Schilling over, Elvis's best friend. Come a couple of days earlier and you can meet him on a personal level. I went over and Jerry was going to the gym. And we're in a little cafe having a coffee. An hour and a half later, he's still there. I've ordered some pizza for us to eat. So far, I haven't asked him anything about Elvis. It's just about him being a human being and me being a human, you know. I think that's the key, you know, is you have to separate the human from Elvis. You can't bombard someone with Elvis questions, right? So at the end of our little coffee thing, I said, oh, you want to do dinner tonight? My shout, you know, so and we'll get a bottle of red or something. Anyway, so we went for dinner, and then all of a sudden he starts talking about Elvis.
Mm.
And that's when he was ready to talk about Elvis. You know, he felt like he could trust me, you know?
Yeah.
So he told me the whole story of when Elvis met the Beatles.
That was in Hollywood.
Yes. Oh, that was, yeah.
And did they jam? Apparently Elvis played bass.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Nothing recorded.
No, that's right.
Right.
So then
Lennon, just by the way, Lennon recalls that period or when he was alive, he said it was very disappointed when he met Elvis in Hollywood that time.
I think so. I think Elvis was probably, you know, boring to them.
Mm.
You know? He was probably in a state where he was just relaxed and wasn't up, you know.
It often happens, I suppose, when you meet your heroes.
Yeah, doesn't it? But I think that's what they were expecting, you know, because they just expected this immediate connection and things like that. But but on the way out, Lennon said to Jerry Schilling, he said, oh, I forgot to tell Elvis, you know, can you just tell him I've got these because of him?
The sideburns.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So
sorry, Mark, I interrupted you, but you said that. So Jerry spoke about that night in Hollywood.
About meeting the Beatles.
Yeah.
And also meeting Nixon.
Right.
That whole story.
Well, I don't know how true is the film where he just left Graceland on his own accord.
Yep.
And he didn't, as we were talking about before, carry a wallet or anything around, but rock up to the airline terminal to go on a flight to Washington.
That's true.
Is that true?
That's true.
With no ID.
I think that... That's right. So he didn't need ID, but...
No, I know, but in the movie, they play up the point that she obviously knows it's Elvis, but she goes, well, I need some ID to book your ticket.
Right, okay. But I think he had an argument at home and just stormed out.
Yeah.
And I think he was on his way to LA to see Jerry because Jerry wasn't working for him at the time. He started with Paramount Studios as a video editor, film editor. So he just needed to get away. He just decided for some reason he wants to fly to LA. But flying to LA, he has to go through Washington.
Yeah.
So he got to Washington and got to LA. Then on the way back, he asked Jerry to come back with him. And Jerry was busy, so he couldn't say no to Elvis. So he, you know, said, oh, can we bring one of the boys to meet you in Washington and take you from Washington to Memphis, and then I'll take you to Washington. So,
and the reason for people that don't know, and again, this is the story.
Yep.
Elvis wanted like a special badge. He wanted to not be part of the FBI.
Yeah.
But according to the movie, and you can, whether Jerry Schilling said this to you, he wanted to spy on Lennon. He thought that if he could get Lennon sent out of the country, he said that he'd go undercover and he'd do like drug busts and things like that. Does any of this...
There wasn't any talk of that.
But Nixon ended up giving him a badge, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right, because Elvis was fascinated with the law enforcement.
That's right.
he felt at the time that, you know, the drug world, the illicit drugs and the, you know, was bad for people and people were heading in the wrong direction. But Elvis was fooling himself because at the same time he was addicted to prescribed drugs.
Yeah,
you know, which was
and that famous photo, that black and white photo of Elvis with standing Nixon. Next to Nixon.
Yeah.
Is this true too, Mark? He's the only civilian that was ever armed other than the Secret Service that was ever that close to a president.
Exactly.
Because he was carrying a gun at
that's
the
right.
time.
Yeah. He always carried guns. And,
that's right.
Yeah. And it was funny because I think the gift he gave to Nixon was a gun as well.
Yes, I think you might be right.
Yeah. So, right. Which they freaked out, you know, because they had to inspect the gift.
Yeah, I do. I remember that.
So, anyway.
Mate, it's been fascinating. I really enjoyed having a chat with you. I could chat for hours. All the best with what you guys are doing here with Marley and Marley Retreat. And it was great. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Mark Tabone was my guest today, and everyone has a story. If you enjoyed that and you'd like to share it with others, please do so on your social media networks. And if you have listened to the podcast or this particular episode via Wooshka or Stitcher or Apple Podcasts, then rate and review the podcast. I'd really appreciate it. Until next time, take care.